sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The Dow and the S&P green year to date. But the NASDAQ's still in the red. The Fed sends a rather conflicting signal. Oil surges of 40% from the lows. And our guest today, Fred Vitese, author of The Essential Retirement Guide, A Contrarian's Perspective. All this and much more on episode number 455 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello and welcome. Welcome officially to episode number 455 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, March 20th, 2016. Yeah, it's my birthday. What am I doing? Well, I'm putting together this podcast to make sure we can get it out and the information that we have to talk about for the week. There's some very interesting, conflicting, rather mixed signals coming out of both the economy and the Fed. And we have to talk about that a little bit before we get to our guest today and talk about some of the things that we have to look forward to over the next week. Kind of an interesting birthday. I don't know about you, but birthdays kind of lose their luster a little bit after our 20s maybe. Have you had that same experience where it's kind of like you wake up in the morning when you're 10 years old, you're like, ah, it's my birthday. It's like kind of Christmas, Hanukkah, and New Year's all wrapped up into one, and you're all excited, and it's, you know, the great day ahead. Maybe it's because all the cool gifts that you get back then when you couldn't get them on your own. Then kind of the 20s end and you get 10 more years pass. You're in your 30s, 40s. And now I'm the ripe old age of 51. And here we are. And it's kind of like, what am I doing? Well, I'm here working today. Spending a little time with the family tonight for dinner. Spending time with the family over the weekend. I guess I had a really good time with my son over last week. We'll say that was my birthday week in Panama. So there you go. Anyway, happy birthday to all else who are having birthdays within this period of time as well. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on with regard to the economy, some things that we saw last week, some things that are coming up next week. Now, don't forget, next Friday, markets are closed. Friday the 25th, when we have Good Friday holiday, they'll be celebrated. We still see GDP fourth quarter final come out from the government, but markets are closed, at least the equity markets, the New York Stock Exchange, the NASDAQ, etc., closed in the U.S. for next Friday. Around the world, there's a variety of other markets that will be closed as well. But we did see this week, the Fed did come out with a rather, I guess, mixed slash dovish signal. Even though we were supposed to be following along with their economic indicators, their dot plot, the data points that they had talked about that were so important, it seems that they've backtracked a little bit on that and really have put into the spotlight the whole economic condition of the global environment and the global economies, as well as the dollar. There was a 9-to-1 vote that left interest rates unchanged last week, and they also scaled back on their rate hike expectations for the calendar year 2016. They had been talking up this whole idea that there was going to be four rate hikes. Remember that? Four rate hikes in 2016 after the one that they did in 2015 in December really kind of put a bit of a concerning cloud over the markets. And all of a sudden they scaled back on that, said, but well, maybe only two more rate hikes throughout 2016. Well, that would put probably June squarely in the spotlight for another rate hike, and then they could see what happens throughout the end of the year, and maybe towards the end of the year, September, maybe the December meeting again, another rate hike. And we did see that gold over the last few weeks has been really rising, maybe in anticipation of the fact that the Fed would stand pat. And even though we did see inflation start to tick up, we did see the core consumer price index come in at a year-over-year annualized rate of 2.3%, which is above their target, by the way. And we're also on the unemployment side right in their target. So if we were to follow along with what they had talked about, what they were going to do, the Fed, they would continue to raise rates and they were going to have four rate hikes because if inflation hit their targets, et cetera, et cetera. Well, here we are. And they backed off. Basically telling us that, you know what? Scrap what we said. Even though this is what we thought was going to be the situation, we are seeing some weakness in, well, they keep talking about slack in the labor market, which I guess there is some, but I don't know where it is if we have a 4.9 official unemployment rate and seeing a sub 300,000 initial claims numbers on a weekly basis and a plus 200,000 employment situation, give or take on average, on the official BLS numbers that we see each and every month. I'm not sure where things have changed and what has changed to make them all of a sudden say that, wait, you know what? Ooh, the only thing can be is one thing, right? One thing only. And that's markets. Concerned that the markets didn't like what they did. Concerned that the world is really hurting because they raised rates. So much for the whole idea that we're going to really focus in on the domestic environment, domestic economy to make sure it doesn't overheat. We'd rather, I guess, overshoot on the side of more inflation and the potential for a more robust economic situation related to the employment index than worry about markets coming down and that whole wealth effect situation being a problem. As the dollar moved up, they know that it was a major headwind to many of the large companies that are big exporters in the U.S., and it caused a major problem with many of the commodity prices. So we did see, again, oil kind of shoot up about 40% from the low that we saw in February, closing in on about, what, 39.5? We did see that consumer confidence dipped down last week, came in about 1.7 points below its February meeting mark that was from their official reports. And we did see that housing was still doing pretty well. Building permits didn't do that well, but housing starts were in good shape. Next week, we're going to be seeing the actual numbers from the National Association of Retailers on the existing home sales. We'll see some earnings from Carnival. Nike, they had an interesting announcement last week where they were once again announcing their self-tying or self-adjusting laced shoe. I thought that was pretty cool. I don't know if you saw the videos on that, but pretty cool videos on how the shoe will actually adjust its laces tighter or maybe even self-tie. A little bit of Velcro on the top, it seems, and there's some kind of a mechanism where it would self-tie. That has, would be very well liked by a lot of people, and I thought it was very interesting that in just days before their coming earnings, they announced that. We also saw that, we're also going to see that earnings are going to be coming out on not much on Tuesday, but Wednesday, new home sales figures. We're going to see General Mills, KB Homes, initial jobless claims, and durable goods orders will be on Thursday. Earnings also on Thursday from Finish Line, GameStop, and Winnebago. Last week, I mentioned that we were going to be watching a few different companies, and FedEx actually came in with just a superb earnings announcement and an upside announcement looking like things were going much better for them. Obviously, fuel costs savings have been very beneficial, and they're not seeing that much of a global slowdown in shipping. So that was kind of good to see. We saw Tiffany, on the other hand, really complain about a lot of their numbers. Caterpillar came out, even though Caterpillar was up on this news. This was kind of interesting. Caterpillar actually was up about 2% on the news that their earnings had dipped down and their anticipated expectations. This was a mid-quarter update, but it looked terrible. We know the CapEx spending between miners and between the oil companies that use a lot of these kind of rigs and different heavy machinery were being cut and slashed anywhere, I don't know, 50 to 70%. We've been seeing that all over the place. Caterpillar did come in and confirm that, yeah, that's what's happening. We're seeing a lot less orders come in around the world, domestically and internationally. And what you saw was that Caterpillar seemed to bounce off that. The stock, when the announcement came out, pre-market was down about, I guess 5 or 6%. So it was hitting on some serious lows there. And I think finished up the day, did a nice reversal, finished up 2%. So that's either a sign that there is a major risk appetite that's going on and that people seeing through this number into the future that Now oil approaching that $40 mark and gold going up probably the highest, one of the close to the highest points in 2016. And maybe those things are going to help to quell the lack of expenditures and CapEx expenditures by many companies that are that deal with Caterpillar products. And maybe there's going to be some benefit in the long-term turnaround and acknowledgement that this may be the low point. We'll see if that happens. But it was a pretty, I thought, a pretty dour announcement that came out from Caterpillar, as well as Tiffany's. Tiffany's clearly saw a slowdown in the higher-end expenditures, and the stock kind of held in there pretty well. I was kind of surprised with that one as well. But again, we're in a situation where there is all of a sudden, snap, a risk appetite that's back in the markets, and that could be due to the fact that we have a massive amount of stimulus that's being put forth by the ECB. China is not, at least they're saying, they're not devaluing their yuan, and that may come post the G20 meeting where there's some scuttlebutt that there was a little private deal cut that China is not going to do any kind of devaluation of the currency, at least in the near-term situation. We saw that Japan is a negative interest rates now, and now put on top of that, the Fed is staying with their current rate hike at 0.25%, and looks like they're not going to be very aggressive in their rate hiking mechanism. So there is some good news that was breathed into the markets. And again, because of all of the things that have gone on, because the Bank of Japan, ECB, et cetera, we did see that the NASDAQ climbed about 1% for the week. Dow was up 2.25% for the week. The S&P up 1.5%, about 1.5% at the week. And like I said, gold was at 2055 to close the week. Overall, pretty good. Dow now up 1% for the year. NASDAQ down 4.5%. S&P up marginally at 0.28% for the year. But really, if you think about that, all that being considered, we've come a long way, baby, a long way from where we were in February, and it looks like the sentiment has changed as well. Now, there's some interesting reports out that show that, you know, where's this buying coming from? Big question about who's actually putting money back into the stock market. And there was a recent study done on Bloomberg showed that most of this is by companies doing buybacks. That as investors are taking money out of the market, companies are continuing to plow money into their own stock. And that could be a big part of this, especially because we know the quiet period at the beginning of the year, something that we talked about and I had looked at, but didn't really believe that it was going to be this powerful, that when that quiet period ended and when the companies were unable to be purchasing their shares ahead of earnings, et cetera, when that expired, that we were going to see more money coming back into the markets, and it did. Now, whether or not this survey is going to hold and we're going to see another potential leg down when the quiet period starts up again next quarter, where companies are going to be laying off their stock buyback programs to a degree and insiders can't buy anymore. And if, in fact, we're going to see that there is the continuation of retail investors pulling money out of the equity markets, we'll see. But that does not at all explain what happened with emerging markets, which, again, oil was a big part of that, and commodity-driven economies had really seen a big turnaround due to the fact that there was this big increase in oil and gold and copper, etc. And of course, one of the risk sentiment issues that had been really weighing on markets for some time was the widening yield spreads, divergence between high grade yielding bonds, you know, AA, BBB, AAA bonds of companies, and the high yield or junk bonds or below investment grade bonds. That yield had really blown out to epic proportions for a while as oil was coming down, as there was a concern for defaults. And as we discussed again last week, one of the things that companies have done is that they went out and they issued secondaries into the marketplace, brought in just a heap of cash to put back on their balance sheets in order to allow for them to have money and really time in order to pay back some of the debt or to at least keep paying the interest on the debt they had. And that gave a breath of life into the energy space, particularly the smaller companies that were really hurting due to the fact that oil dropped. And as Oil came back, and now they have more money on their balance sheets. These stocks ripped higher. I mean, just an incredible move to the upside. With that, their bonds also started to stabilize. And with that stabilization, the markets took that as a cue that, hey, wait, you know what? Maybe things aren't that bad. So you combine this all together with central banking activity, with the fact that oil and commodities started to rally a bit. Dollar came down off of its highs. The Fed was much more dovish. Balance sheet monies were repositioned so that there could be a much better view of the opportunity for companies to pay back their debt. Less of a concern by many people with regard to the ability for companies to pay and potential defaults and maybe not defaulting in the future, at least putting it off for some time. And then on top of that, you had companies coming in and doing buybacks. All that pushed things much higher to a point that we're pretty much even on the year now, from about down 10%, 11%, depending on the market, to pretty much flat on the year. The big question is what happens next? Now let's take a look at oil for a second. There were many saying that, you know what, $50 oil is not happening, like ever. You know, this is kind of like when oil was at 110, everybody's like, oil's never going down again. Kind of put those aside, those outlier kinds of commentary that we see. But let's take a look at oil for a second. If you look at the chart on the current contract on crude futures, WTI crude, again, currently in this, right in about this 39.50, we'll call it just under 40 range. Well, oil has a range right now, it looks like, from about 33.50 from what we see, up to about 40.50. Pretty wide range, about $7. From here, if we do in fact break out, if there is a lot more short covering and we do see that things turn and the dollar maybe comes down, risk appetite continues, the shorts get squeezed, you probably have up to about $45 on the top end of oil from the point of technical analysis on the chart, where we're looking at the past levels where there was high volume trading and where it pretty much stopped out. If you take a line and just draw a line across 45 and look at the current contract of oil, you'll see that 45 pretty much is the top line. The bottom, $30. So we had a double bottom here at $30. We have a double top at $39.50. The big question is, where do we break? Clearly, the momentum is in favor of the upside. If you're just looking at momentum and you're looking at sentiment, and you're looking at directional move on the near term, clearly the upside breakout is the highest probability move. If we do see that, you're going to see the continuation of the high yield bonds. Their credit get a lot better. You're going to see that there is a opportunity for markets to say, well, that's pretty good in the energy sector to get a little bit of reprieve, hoping that earnings will stabilize and not be as negative or more negative than anticipated. Therefore, the whole entire S&P gets a lift. So again, that momentum, if you look at it, the current momentum is to the upside. The question is, how strong are the bears or how strong are the players in there that recently loaded up, willing to push it to see if they can get above that 40 and a half level? Not too far away from where we are now, 3 or 4%. So all we're talking about, a 3 or 4% push, and there's a big wide gap, a hole, as we call it. If you look at the chart, there's a hole. We call it a hole because there was very little volume played from about 45 when it dropped down to 40. And that area, there really is no sense of institutional players that are really holding positions at those levels. And oftentimes, sometimes they call them gaps. That gap will be filled. So the momentum, again, is over the 40 and a half side is to 45. And again, I'm focusing on this because really the whole market has focused on the price of oil for the whole, the last 4 or 5 months, maybe even longer. There are so many things that are affected with this. Now, on the outside, the big question is, well, if oil prices go up and gas prices go up, does that mean that maybe consumers will not spend as much? Already consumers, with the low price of oil and the super low price of gasoline that we've seen as it's come down recently, have not spent. They haven't said, whoa, look at that. Wow. You know, I'm going to go spend. Hasn't happened. As a matter of fact, when we look at the numbers that we saw just the last few weeks, we saw that the overall level of retail sales and the increase of the actual amount being spent was like, I don't know, 0.1% down the downside. In other words, a negative 0.1 compared to February. Now, how do you square that with the fact that oil has been so depressed and gasoline prices have been so depressed and people have a lot more money in their pocket net of their pay because of pay and taxes, and now that oil is where it is? I mean, how do you square all that? More money in my pocket, but I'm not spending. Well, we did see sentiment did tick down. We talked about that, but something's just not right. Maybe consumers are retracting a little bit. Maybe consumers are seeing that long-term, hey, you know what? Oil's not going to stay at these low levels forever. I'm going to bank some of this money right now for when tougher times come, whenever that may be. But you also have more employed. So again, you know, you have this very weird circumstance happening right now with more people employed, more money in their pocket. Yeah, no, there's no real wage growth going on. Prices down overall, and they're still not spending. So it ticked down in February. So with that, we'll have to see how the actual price increase in oil now affects the retail sales in the future. You'd have to say that if they're not spending and they have more money in their pocket, when there's less money in their pocket because they're paying more at the pump, there's going to be even less spending. Now, you won't see this on television, on radio. Most are going to say, well, you know, oil prices on the upside have real no effect on the economy. Of course, on the downside is very beneficial. Well, we just debunked that. The last 6 months to a year, we've debunked that entire theory. There is no truth to the fact that oil prices on the upside don't do anything and don't hurt the economy. But if they move down, it's much more beneficial to the economy. Well, we know that's not the fact. We know that just has no weight here. So let's take a look at oil. Watch oil for that breakout above, we'll call it 40-50, maybe a few cents in either direction. But 40-50 is a good number to look at. And that break then to 45, which should be, as unless momentum gets really out of control, unless there is some real curtailing of drilling and OPEC does something very significant to state that they are going to actually cut back versus just freeze oil production. So 45 should be the top in the midterm. And I wouldn't be surprised if, just because sentiment is so positive right now, so many shorts have unwound their positions, if we are going to see maybe a test back to the midpoint, probably I would say maybe about the probably 33.50 level. That would probably be something that would start to be more of a reality if we don't break above the 40.50. All right, with that, a couple of things I want to mention. First of all, if you listen to DH Unplugged or if you don't listen to DH Unplugged, we have the Close to the Pin contest that is going on, where you guess a price of a stock that we have predetermined. And what happens is that you have the opportunity to take your price guess, and about a week later, 2 weeks later, depending on the actual contest, we actually see who came closest to the actual price on the closing date that we've announced. You'll see all the rules, all the information over on DH Unplugged, a great podcast that we do each and every week, myself and John C. Dvorak. I think you'll enjoy that. It's a bit of business, a lot of humor. I actually had someone write in last week that said they had to stop listening to it at the gym because they were laughing so hard the last few times that they were, I guess, falling off their treadmill or something, or dropping weights on their toes. I don't know, something. But they thought it was a pretty interesting podcast, much different than this one. This one is much more interview-centric, talking about things to help you with your finances, to give you some of the business news, some technical analysis, fundamental analysis, a whole swath of information that we bring to you here. That one is much more news and current news driven, and talking about some of the weird developments that happen and trying to debunk some of the much more common, we'll call them, well, not facts, but the theories that are out there, and come up with some of solutions of our own to make us some money, and also, of course, investment-centric. All right, so DH Unplugged, listen to that each and every Tuesday. Get that on iTunes or any other place that you listen to your podcasts. And of course, if you want to write me, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can also follow me on Twitter. Andrew Horowitz is my Twitter handle. We're going to get to our guest, and I want to, you know, just for a moment here, I thought it would be, every once in a while, I want to change it up and talk a little bit about some other topics outside just the investment world, just the, you know, basic things that we do in terms of stocks or bonds or investing in ETFs and things like that. Because where are we going with all this, right? What's the whole point? It's not just the point of investing. There's an end game involved here, right? Something for the future, trying to make money for, fill in the blank, retirement, college savings, a rainy day, right? It's just not a game just to be there making money. There is an end game here. So what I did was we went out and we found someone who I thought would be very interesting. Let's get to them right now. And our guest today, Fred Vitese, he's the chief actuary at Morneau Chappell, which is one of the largest human resources and consulting and technology companies and one of the top five defined benefit pension providers in North America. Now, you're wondering, what are we talking with this guy for? Because we're going to change it off. We talk a lot about investing. We talk a lot about, you know, some of the things that are happening in markets, economics. But what about that end game? And he wrote a book called The Essential Retirement Guide. And the subtitle of it is A Contrarian's Perspective. So I thought we'd find out more about that. So, Fred, you're with us, right?
Yes, I am. Hi.
Great. Well, good to have you. I appreciate you coming on and talking about some of this important topics.
My pleasure.
Now, you know, one of the things, let's just start out with the title. You talk about The Essential Retirement Guide, A Contrarian's Perspective. So what does that mean? What's so important, and why are you calling it A Contrarian's Perspective?
Well, I would be the first person to admit that calling anything essential is somewhat presumptuous. It was supposed to be a working title, but somehow or other it stuck. The reason why I call it A Contrarian's Perspective is that some of the major themes in the book are different from what you hear again and again being spouted by financial planners and advisors and so on. So that's why I call it that.
So a couple of the themes that you have discussed in the book, which is really kind of interesting. I mean, some of it is obviously done with a lot of, we'll call it, research and substance behind it. You're not just spitting out information, and you obviously the actuary and numbers crunching kind of guy that you are, right? You came up with some of these important features and themes here. But one is this whole idea of a lot of people are targeting a percentage of their pay to be what they should be retiring on. You know, like, well, yes, you know, I make $100,000 a year, so probably when I retire, I'll only need, you know, 70-80%. But I think that you had questioned some of that, right?
Yes, I did. Yeah. I'm actually saying that it's nowhere close to 70 or 80%, and I say that because the vast majority of us in our lifetimes end up having a mortgage on a house and also end up having children. And when you got those two things, you end up living on less than 40% of your pay for the vast majority of your working life. And it's easy to look at the math on that. Let's just take somebody with $100,000 worth of earnings. They probably have mortgage payments amounting to maybe 20% in most years. They also have children expenses that might be another 20%. Then they're putting aside maybe 10% for retirement. Then there's employment expenses. And finally, there's income tax. And when you take all those things off, what they have left to spend on themselves would be less than 40%. So they're doing this virtually their whole working lifetime. Then all of a sudden, they're told that they need 70% to 80% at retirement. And why would that be? I mean, the only way that would make any sense is if they want to have a much better lifestyle in retirement than they ever had when they were working. And I have no problem with that, as long as people are doing it with their eyes wide open. But they're being told they need that just to maintain the same lifestyle, and that just isn't true.
So one of the so let's just go back to the old 70% number. You know, that's what it was. And you're saying, well, that may be somewhat of a too high of a number, because obviously what happens is you're no longer going to have to, well, and hopefully your kids are independent, and hopefully you paid off your mortgage. I mean, all these things that go into the equation, of course, right? So when you retire, you don't have that necessarily that mortgage payment. You still have your utility bills and things like that, of course, but not the mortgage payment. You'll still have a car payment potentially. You'll still obviously have to eat. You still have to do things. And you won't have the kids, which maybe amount to 20% or so, or for some of us, even more throughout your lifetime.
Pretty easily. Yeah.
You know? So let's say they're at, let's just go with a different number, 50%. So 50% of income. So now you need $50,000 of income to pay for the same things that you were paying or on a relative basis. That's fine. And I have no problem with that. So why were people suggesting this other number all these years?
I don't know why.
That's honest enough.
If one wishes to be cynical, because a bigger number would be in their best interests. If you look at the mutual fund companies, financial advisors, and so on, they're making most of their remuneration based on a percentage of assets under management. So the more money that people are setting aside for retirement, the bigger their nest eggs that they have, and then the more money that these companies are making. So it would be in their best interest to have people putting aside more money. That would be one reason, and obviously that's a pretty cynical reason, and I wouldn't like to say that most of the people are in that camp. A second reason would just be sheer conservatism. They might even believe it's really 50%, but there's no harm in saying 70%, right? People will just put more money aside, and isn't that a good thing? I'm saying it's not necessarily a good thing because you live your whole life. You're not just living at age 80. You're also living at when you're 35, 40. And I want people to have all the facts at their disposal so they know how much money they can actually spend when they're 40 without being scared into saving ridiculous amounts for retirement.
Is some of the potential because when you're earning income and you're in that stage when you're going, you know, pre-retirement, that the potential for risk, whereas if you lose money, if you lose money in the markets and you have that built up for your nest egg and you're not on a defined pension plan, you're on just some kind of a wealth that you've accumulated and you're living on that. And if you lose money, well, you need more of a margin of safety, whereas in time when you're working, you have much greater earnings power. Is that potentially one of the things that could play into this?
It plays into it to some extent, but really not that much. I mean, the fact of the matter is that we have a lot of flexibility in how much we actually need just to kind of live on or how much we would like to have to live on. And so, if you go from age 30 to age 40 and at 30 you're single without any mortgage payments, whatever, by age 40 you've got two kids and a mortgage, you're still living. And the fact is you're spending a lot less on yourself than you used to spend, but you still get by. I mean, because people are rather flexible in terms of their income needs. And we actually don't lose that flexibility all that much after retirement. Obviously, we need enough money for food and shelter. But apart from that, we have a lot of flexibility in everything else we have. Mm-hmm. And there have been studies done by, say, the Society of Actuaries that show that the percentage of people who are confident about their financial security or financial situation, it's fairly low before a retirement. When they look ahead, they're concerned about whether they'll have enough. And then it actually goes up pretty substantially. So it might go up from, say, 40% to, say, 65%, 70% before versus after retirement. The reason why it goes up is because before retirement, they just don't know, number one. Number two, they've been told again and again, you're not saving enough and you're headed for trouble. After retirement, they've actually had some experience, and they can see that this is how much they really need and how much they're spending, and they just gain a certain comfort level. And every study I've seen by the Society of Actuaries, Canadian Institute of Actuaries, and some of the big banks have shown the same thing, that people's confidence level and that they have enough money goes up after retirement.
Now, one of the things that's happened over the last number of years is that interest rates have been a lot lower on, we'll call it, safe investments, right? We know that around the world.
Yeah.
Around the world. Now, some may be a bit higher than others, but I mean, right now in the U.S., you go to a bank, in the old days, you'd get some CDs, they maybe paid 4%, and you had some money in the bank, and you can go out as a retired person, even without a lot of money, and you could live, okay and not have a worry. These days, 1%, 0.5%, I mean, it changes the entire structure. Is that changing any of the fundamentals on how much we need to? Well, yes. It obviously does. We have to have a lot more money.
Yes, it does, for sure. And so two things on this. First of all, if there's any kind of feeling, well, this is only a short-term phenomenon, it's because we're kind of still in quasi-recession. We had the 2008-2009 recession and then quantitative easing and the government forced interest rates down. But don't you worry, one of these days it'll get back up to normal again. I used to think that myself. After having done the research and as I've laid out in the book, I no longer think that's the case. I think we're looking at low interest rates, like really low interest rates, for the next 20 or 30 years. And that might seem crazy, but that's essentially what's happened in Japan. And the whole reason for it is because of an aging population. You have a lot more people now who are savers, because they're over age 50, mm-hmm. Than borrowers. And that changes supply and demand. the more supply you have of money and less demand for it in terms of borrowing, then the lower interest rates are going to be. And we saw that first in Japan starting in the 1990s, and then it affected Europe and Canada and now the United States. And in another 5 years' time, it's going to be affecting China as well, because they actually have a rapidly aging population. So this is going to be a worldwide phenomenon where we're going to have a lot of old people with money who are looking for a place to save it and invest it. And as a result, interest rates are going to be staying low for a long time to come. So yes, it will affect how much money you need. And my purpose in my book isn't to tell people don't save and don't worry about retirement. It's just to give them the facts that, yes, good news, your retirement income target as a percentage of final income is lower than you think. Bad news, you'll need more money just to get that much income.
Right. So, I mean, so the amount of money you may need these days may be the equivalent of what you needed before with the 70% target, when maybe even you only need 40, 50% today.
Correct.
Yeah. So we didn't get anywhere. We're rowing upstream.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
That's true. And as a result of it, it means that people can't really put their money into CDs or in cash because, as you say, they're only earning 0.5% or 1% of interest. They're going to have to put their money into other investments. Unfortunately, it means that they may have to take a bit more risk if they want to manage their own monies and maybe put a higher percentage of the money into stocks than they otherwise would feel comfortable doing. And that'll be difficult for a lot of older people to do. The other thing they might do, and this makes a lot of sense, and I talk about this for some length in the book, is they may want to purchase an annuity instead.
So, well, that's interesting because there's been a lot. I actually had two discussions recently this week with people that said, what is all these TV advertisements about how annuities are so bad and this whole terrible, there's a bit of a campaign going on by, I think, Ken Fisher and a few others about, you know, annuities are a big ripoff and all that. The problem is, I think you would agree too, yes, there are annuities that are ripoffs. There are annuities that aren't good. There are annuities that may be just very appropriate for somebody. It all depends on, well, the person, what they're trying to accomplish, if the annuity is a good deal or not, you know, a lot of the components behind it. It's like anything else, right? You know, there's good things and bad things out there. But I was interested because you did talk about this a lot in the book, and I don't know if there's a difference between the annuities that are issued in Canada versus the annuities that are issued in the U.S., but, you know, can you give me a little bit more of an expansion on this? Because
there really isn't a difference between Canada and the U.S. I mean, it's about the same situation in both places. And, yeah, the underlying interest rates for annuities are low, which means that the cost of an annuity seems to be high. And so that you have the same dynamic in both places. But I'm saying, in spite of that, they still make sense. For example, you know, right now the interest rates are like 2.5%. The insurance company doesn't tell you that, but when they do their calculations, it's essentially based on about a 2.5% interest rate. But what that ends up producing is an annuity that ends up being about 6% of your nest egg. So if you have, say, $100,000 that you want to be putting into an annuity, you can extract an annual income of about $6,000 on that, so 6%. And you might say, well, it doesn't sound so great, but it's pretty good compared to the fact that these same financial advisors are saying that if you are managing your own money, you better not be taking out any more than 3 or 4% because it's not safe anymore under these low interest rates. You can take out 6% safely under an annuity, and even if you live until 104, you're going to keep on getting those payments the whole time.
Right. The one caveat, though, is you're talking about a fixed annuity, of course, which is guaranteed and safe by the annuity company, and it is annuitized annuity, whereas the where annuity stream, it's not a deferred, it's an immediate annuity, whereas the stream of the income that comes to you is not only interest, but is part of your principal. So therefore, also, by the way, just a quick caveat, you do get you don't get taxed on the full 6%. You only get a partial taxation just on the amount that's attributable to the interest rate. However, as you did mention, it is income for the rest of your life guaranteed. When you die, again, there's a lot of caveats here. Did you have a joint in life, a joint in 50, whatever it is? But the point is, when you die, let's just say you do this, when you die, there's no more money left. So if you were going to plan on passing that to your heirs, obviously there wouldn't be any monies available. Now, with that said, with that whole discussion, and you may say, wow, my God, why would I want to go through my own money? Well, the point of retirement is to have enough money to live and to last your lifetime with your income. And if you're also planning on retirement and the retirement of your family, that's a different discussion. You know, your kids, your grandkids, and so on for generations to come, that's a different story. If you're planning on doing the right things for your retirement and providing for yourself throughout your lifetime while, you know, assuming you didn't get an inheritance, assuming you didn't get anybody else's big chunk of money that sets you up, then that's where this comes into play as being a very viable instrument, right?
Yeah, that's right. So if you decide to maintain your own portfolio and draw an income from that after retirement, so the danger you have in that case is that you'll outlive your money, and because of low interest rates or some kind of financial setback or whatever. So the problem with that is that you might outlive your money, but say you might run out when you're 85 years of age, but you may end up living until 100. So that's your problem there, that you're alive and the worst has come to pass. You have no money left. With an annuity, it's kind of the opposite problem. The problem is that you might die young. You might die at 70, even though the annuity kind of assumed you would live until age 85. You died at 70 and there's no money going to your heirs, as you say. But the thing is that outcome is a lot less worrisome, should be a lot less worrisome to you than the outcome if you're managing your money, because at that point you're dead. I mean, it did what it had to do. It provided you the income that you needed for your lifetime. You didn't live as long as you wanted, and not having money to pass on is a bit of a problem. Being dead is a much bigger problem.
Yeah, when you're dead, you're probably not going to be upset about the fact that you made the wrong decision.
Exactly.
All right, let me ask you something else. You know, you talk about long-term care insurance here. Now, one of the things that's really fascinating about the long-term care industry is I remember it back many years ago when it first really started to get popular. And I think I even remember, I dare say, when it started, you know, the whole thing where you got long-term care policies and there was this implied guarantee of never having a rate increase and all that. And a lot of the insurance companies got themselves in trouble with that. But if you think about what are the cost factors that change, we just talked about it. So you don't have the kids anymore that you're paying for their various lifestyle, college, et cetera. You're not paying for your mortgage and all that. And those are things that you had to pay for back then. The other thing is that what comes up upon retirement and later on in life is what could be those things that would all of a sudden happen. Well, your kid can come back and live with you or require money. That's, you can't insure against that, I don't think. At least I haven't. You know what? Maybe there's a plan we can come up with. Long-term kid plan, something like that, which seems to be more and more popular these days in the way things are going. But one of the things that does happen is your health fails and you're no longer able to do what's called the, quote, daily activities, the activities of daily living, whether it's dressing, bathing, feeding, driving, all these other things. Mm-hmm. And what happens is then you have to bring someone in to help you, whether it's going to be in your home or you're going to have to be in an assisted living facility or possibly in a nursing home. The one that most people choose off the bat, if they do need somebody, is to live at their own home and have somebody come in either part-time or full-time. And that could be a very significant strain, right?
Yeah,
so
that's correct.
You talk about this in the book, that one of the things that you want to do in the future is cover yourself for these type of potentialities, whereas you're going to have this happening, and that could be a gigantic strain on that 40% number or 50% number that we talked about, right? So you buy a long-term care policy, et cetera, right? Is that something that you're talking through, and it's...
Yeah, it could be straight on that, I guess, in certain situations. But here's the thing. First of all, less than half of all people will ever need long-term care. First of all, in fact, it's more like maybe a third in the case of men, closer to half in the case of women. Second, when they do need long-term care, on average, they'll need it for maybe a year or 2 years. So the situations do exist where people will need long-term care for 10 or even 20 years, but those are the exceptions. So you might think, well, you need long-term care insurance in order to cover those exceptions. Here's why I don't like long-term care insurance. There's a bunch of reasons, but the biggest reason is that it's just the opposite of what you want from insurance. What you want is modest premiums, but if something happens, you're totally covered. Long-term care insurance, first of all, the premiums aren't modest, depending upon when you start and the kind of policy you take. It could be $10,000 a year. The premiums are not modest. They're actually very hefty. You have to continue with them for the rest of your life. You cannot stop at a given point in time and change companies or whatever. But in spite of that, it doesn't cover you. You still may end up having extensive long-term care expenses over and above what the insurance provides. So, as I say, just the opposite. Premiums are not modest, and you're not fully covered if you have a situation. In the book, I talk about one situation where I took an actual policy that someone takes out at age 54, and they making the premiums for the rest of their life. And then I look at, I guess, a pretty common kind of situation where they actually need the insurance around age 85, 86. And they need it for about 4 years, which is a bit longer than the average. But anyway, I made that as an illustration. So normally you think, you know, if you have an insurance policy and then there's a claim, then thank God you had the insurance, you're covered. So the funny thing is, I did this example, and I found that that you're actually better off not having the insurance even when you got that claim. That if you actually set aside an equal amount of money every year until you were 85, 86, and invested it, got about 4% interest, you actually would be better off than if you'd bought the insurance. So...
I mean, but the only thing, Fred, you have to have the discipline to do so. It's kind of like life insurance in a way. Like, you know, you want to have this life insurance to prevent yourself from an early death. I mean, take out life insurance today for $1 million, and you die 2 years later. Woohoo! You won. You know, you beat the odds.
Yeah, right.
Not good for you, but good for good for your family.
Yeah, but the other thing too is that I would say the majority of people who are looking at long-term care insurance, I mean, they actually have the kind of cash flow that they can even think about it, also end up having their own home. They actually own a home. And if you happen to be the last survivor, and this is usually the situation where you have the woman, the wife survives the husband, and now she's 85, 88, and so she needs long-term care. She still has the house paid for, and then the whole home equity can actually be used to pay for that long-term care. So she doesn't actually need to make all those payments throughout the years.
Or possibly even reverse mortgage too, right?
Yeah, reverse mortgage is the other possibility. So for the vast majority of situations, either they don't need it or else they actually have other kinds of assets that they can turn into income that can actually pay for the long-term care insurance. So, I mean, long-term care when that arises.
I remember when I first started in the financial business, not that long ago, but okay, let's call it mid-1980s, kind of what the planning phase, even back then, was. Right, well, I'll go back a little further. Let's talk about 1970s, you know, just getting general education. It was kind of like, you know, you work till you're 65, you retire till you're 75, and then you die. I mean, that's how it was like, right? These days, it's you work, or maybe even you work to 55 and you die at 65. You know, that was the kind of thing. You only need a certain amount of time. These days, people are living a lot longer. Whether it's better or worse in terms of health or not is a different discussion. But they're living a lot longer these days.
Yeah.
So that must come into play with, and the potential is, if we just look at just straight statistics and, you know, trends, that people will be even living longer in the future. Right.
Yeah,
right now,
that's right.
Mm-hmm. Right now, life insurance is gauged to be, I think, at age 100, most people die. That's the assumption, you know, for the most part. In total, I mean, the actuarial is much different. It's much younger when you look at the true grouping. But age 100 is kind of, that's it, done. But people will start potentially living longer. Again, we're not talking about better or worse, whether it's going to be on major drugs or whatever it is. How has that changed planning for retirement?
We are living longer. So, for example, in the book, I talk about somebody age 60, a male age 60, and that kind of individual back in half a century ago would have expected to live until about age 77, mm-hmm. so another 17 years. Today, a male age 60 could expect to live until about age 86, so it's an extra 9 years compared to what they had. 9 years is a lot if you're looking at just the tail end of their lives. Instead of 17, it becomes 26. So that's a pretty big increase. But here's the issue. The issue is that while we're living longer, we're not necessarily living healthier. In the book, I cite some statistics. These are from some U.S. Statistics that show that the number of years of disabled life actually have increased over time as opposed to decreased. So we're actually living more of our retired lives disabled or somehow not fully capable than used to be the case. So we're not living necessarily healthier. So for example, if you're age 50, I show that there's about a chance in two of a healthy 50-year-old male only has a chance in two of surviving until it's 70 without a major critical illness, something serious like cardiovascular disease or Parkinson's or a brain tumor. With that, the way I think this ought to be affecting our retirement planning is that we should be expecting about 10 really good years from a normal retirement age, like say 60, 65, whatever, we ought to be expecting about 10 really good years. And that's what you ought to really focus on in terms of, you know, your spending in retirement. I'm not saying go crazy, but I'm saying, you know, spend it. Assume that you're going to be able to do the things you want to do for only 10 more years, if that's exotic travel or a new hobby or whatever. And I would say don't save too much of it for 75, 80, thinking that's when you're really going to start enjoying life. That probably isn't the case.
That sucks. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, that sucks. I mean, I'll tell you something. So I'm actually going to be officially over 50 by the time the last person listens to this particular episode. 51, turning 51 this week. And, you know, it's interesting because, first of all, I lived in New York when I was born and raised, and I saw all these people moving down to Florida to retire. I'm thinking to myself, why am I going to wait till I'm 65 or 70 to move to Florida if it's a really good place to live? That's what I was thinking at the time, right? And it turned out to be a very good place to live, et cetera. Then I see all these people, well, they're going on cruises, they're going around the world, and they're like 60s and late 50s and 70s. They start going on the tours around the world to Asia, to Europe, to, you know, to Africa. And I'm 30-something. I'm like, why am I going to wait that long to do that? I don't understand. Yeah. Why. What's the waiting game for? I could drop dead tomorrow. So you know, I think that there's something to be said about, you know, taking advantage of your life now, because you don't know what the future holds. At the same time, proper planning to make sure that the future will hold a very bright opportunity for yourself. But, you know, live now and live then, both. Don't give up one for the other. I think that's some of the subtext of what you're saying.
That's that is correct. In the book, I have a chapter about how consumption falls with age. In other words, the amount of money we spend. And we're not spending less money because we have less money. We spend less money because we just aren't inclined to spend as much money, or haven't got the capability when we're older. And this is a phenomenon that's happening everywhere in the world. There are studies with a lot of, a massive amount of data from the United States, Canada, Germany, and most recently the UK. They all show the same thing. They show that we kind of keep our spending pretty much on a normal basis throughout our 60s. I mean, we do our traveling and keep on spending money the way we always did, maybe even a bit more for a little while. But then after 70, something happens between 70 and 75. That seems to be the tipping point where we actually start spending less money, and our assets, instead of drawing our assets down, they actually start going up again. We actually see our remaining nest egg actually increasing if you save properly, even though it should be decreasing. And the reason why that happens is, and they looked at all the possible reasons, but it looks like it's happening because this is around the time when we become a little bit more fragile. We may not be able to drive anymore. We may have arthritis, and maybe something more serious like Parkinson's or whatever. But as a result of which, we just don't have quite the capability of spending money the way we used to. Exotic travel may be out the window. You're no longer buying things like durables, like furniture and so on, like you used to buy before. And the other reason is because your spouse may have died, and you just don't seem to be, you aren't as inclined to travel as you used to be. And this shouldn't come as a surprise to any of us. I mean, we all have had, you know, aged parents or other relatives, and we've seen that, you know, they end up spending less money on those kinds of things as they get older. Yep. And that's what the statistics bear out. And so we have to learn from this and say, well, let's make the most of our 60s, and hopefully, if we keep your fingers crossed, our early 70s, make the most of that time, as opposed to saving every penny until we're 85.
Right. I hear you. Okay, Fred, I appreciate it. The author of The Essential Retirement Guide, A Contrarian's Perspective, available all over the place that you buy books. So I appreciate you spending the time with us.
Okay. My pleasure.
All right. Talk to you. Bye-bye. With that, we're going to call an end to this episode. And again, thank you very much for all your warm wishes. I got some great emails and tweets and Facebook comments on my birthday. Thank you so much for thinking about me. Thank you so much for being with me each and every week on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Again, it's great to have you as a friend, a listener, and really appreciate all your feedback and your commentary. Really, I do. I appreciate it very much. Thank you so much. All right, we'll see you again next week.
Podcast. podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.